one in the position of a coma? Like some of you meditating. Well, I've noticed. No, if someone is in a coma, is it possible they choose their chitta to let go, the body and everything, and die? When in this position, is it possible to attain nibbana? A coma, there's two types of coma, as you know. The one is basically you can't sort of receive any information and you can't respond to anything. That's basically you're in a sort of very black space. There was a lady I knew, and she actually, listened to her giving a talk of what it was like to be in a coma. And she would say it's this really black, dark space. And interestingly, it was not sort of pleasant at all. It was just nothing really going on. And interestingly, what brought her out of that coma was sound. Now, and that's one thing the Buddha says, that in the deep meditation, if you really get into the jhana, fine, you don't hear sound. But if you're on the edge of a very weak first jhana, it is sound which brings you out. In the same way, it's sound which wakes you up in the morning when you hear your alarm clock glow. So it's the sound is the last of the senses which you can let go of. And the reason is, it's because our last line of defense, we hear the tiger in the jungle, the burglar breaking into our house in the dark. We haven't got sight, but sound is our last defense. Which is one of the reasons why we also don't like to let go of these senses, because unless you're in a safe environment, we think all of my protective mechanisms are now disabled. I can't see, I can't hear, smell, taste, touch. Ah! But the sound is the last of those alarms which you let go of. And in the coma, she heard the sound bringing her back into her body. So she came back into her body in a hospital bed in Singapore, and she could see and hear everything which was being done around her, but she couldn't speak, she couldn't move. So in that type of coma is well known. That's where people can actually, they can receive information, they know everything which is happening, but they can't sort of respond. And in her particular case, it was fascinating and very scary, because she soon heard, she saw her sons by the bedside having a conference with her doctor. And the doctor was saying that she's dead, she's gone, there's no chance of survival, can I turn off the life support? And she was trying to say, no, I'm still here, I'm not dead. And being Chinese family, the younger son said, well, it's the oldest son's job. You have to make the decision. And he said, no, I can't take responsibility for my mother's life and death. You have to help me. And they said, no. And so in the end, it had to be the oldest son's decision. Turn on off the life support and then she'd die, or keep it going. And she said she could hear all of this. And she was terrified. You know, her son was about to kill her, and you know, she couldn't say anything. So she said, you know, she came through obviously afterwards, and she said she was willing with every ounce of willpower she had to try and say, son, don't turn it off, I'm still here, don't turn it off. And then he was thinking for a while and said, keep her going for another day. And that's all it took for her to start to move her fingers. And they realized that she was coming back, and she made full recovery. And that's why she could tell what it was like to be in a coma, and especially just emerging from a very dark place through sound, and be able to hear and see everything which was going on, but not being able to talk back. Which is one of the reasons why, if you have a relation in a coma, just talk to them. Tell them the latest news. You know, if they're Sri Lankan, tell them who won the World Cup cricket, because they're dying to know. Whatever it is. Tell them if they're a business person, how the stock market's going. You know, whatever it is, because they really want to know, but they can't sort of tell you. And the other thing is to hold their hands, you know, touch them, because they want to have that, they can feel. And eventually they can maybe, when you stimulate them that way, they can maybe actually come back to life again. That's to bring them out of a coma. But if you're really in a deep, actually, Ajahn Chah's coma experience, because he was in a coma, in a sense, he couldn't speak or do anything. But they had that story that he would get into jhanas. So, you know, everyone realized that, you know, he hadn't gone. He hadn't disappeared. He wasn't a vegetable. It was actually that's one of my jokes. Well, the vegetable joke? It doesn't matter, you're going to get it anyway. Now, which vegetable joke? Not the carrot joke. Okay. Sorry? Yes. Right, it's a terrible joke. Is there any vegetarians here? Please leave. It's how does a vegetarian, how they're able to eat steaks? Very easy. How does a vegetarian eat steak without breaking their vows? So you take a cow, you give a cow like lobotomy, and then when the cow, and under anaesthetic, you know, humanely, and when the cow comes out of anaesthetic, because of the lobotomy, it's a vegetable. And then you can eat it. It's a vegetable, so you can eat vegetables. How vegetarian can eat a steak? Anyway, let's get back to the question. Sorry? Bad thoughts. Yeah, I know, but... So, that's what Ajahn Chah was up to. So he wasn't a vegetable, you know, even though he couldn't speak. Because every now and again, you know, had a doctor, he would stop breathing. And he would actually not be breathing at all. And the doctor was really scared. If he doesn't breathe, he's going to die. And the monk said, no, he's just into these deep meditations. And the interesting thing of this story, the doctor, you know, it's actually a medic. He was really scared that, you know, if he didn't do anything, if he let Ajahn Chah die, he'd be in big trouble. You know, Thai, they're really scared. You know, maybe he made bad karma, let Ajahn Chah die. So he wanted to get him breathing again, and the monk said no, and he said yes, the monk said no, so they came to a compromise. And the compromise was an interesting little bit of experiment that the doctor took blood samples every few minutes to make sure the blood was oxygenated. As long as the blood was oxygenated and the blood oxygen was going to the brain, there would be no problem at all. And even though Ajahn Chah wasn't breathing, the blood was always well oxygenated all this time for a couple of hours. So the doctor sort of let him, okay, you can just, don't need to breathe. Somehow or other, oxygen was being absorbed, maybe through the pores or whatever it was. Enough oxygen was going in to keep the basic life functions going. So, but, you know, without breathing. So an interesting experiment. That's what happens when you're in deep meditation. But can they choose the citta to let go of the body and everything, and when in this position it's possible to aid nirvana? Now, what would happen, the person, if they have been meditating before, haven't been meditating, you just don't know how to let go. So you're stuck there, you can hear, you can see, and stuff like that, but you can't really let go of those five senses. You know, you're aware all the time. And because you're aware all the time, you don't know how to let go. You're sitting there, you can feel everything, see everything, and sometimes that happens for years. So, you know, they don't go to nirvana, and eventually their body just wears out and dies like everybody else's. However, if you are in a coma where you can't receive any sensory input, you know, then quite often people do die. Because one of the causes for life is the nutriments, is like contact, sensory experience. If you don't have sensory experience, then you just die. The sensory experience, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, is necessary as much as food is for you to carry on living. One of the other things the Buddha said, the nutriments, is will. If you lose the will to live, people die. And, you know, that often happens when you see people who've been married for a long time together. And when one of them dies, the other one dies pretty soon afterwards. They literally lose the will to live, and therefore they cannot sustain this life. So contact, you know, the passa, the sensory experience, is one of the nutriments. So is will. So that's what happens if you go into a coma. Dear Raja, what about automatic for people in wheelchairs and my old mum? Noiseless for all of us meditators and anti-reflective coated so the birds don't attack their own reflections, sliding doors into this hall. The next project to fundraise, well, perhaps with metta, a little bit of cheekiness and respect. So you want to have new doors for this hall, noiseless, anti-reflective. Oh, you mean the doors to your rooms, your huts, because the glass, you don't have glass doors, you have wooden doors for the huts, but where you have some glass windows, the glass on the side of the doors, the birds love attacking that because they see their reflections in there. and they attack themselves. Just like some of you see your reflections of your bad karmas and you attack yourself by saying, I'm not good enough, I'm hopeless, you get guilty. So you're just as bad as those birds, attack yourself. Why do you attack yourself? You've done some bad karma, let it go, you're not a bad person. Don't make it worse by saying, I'm hopeless, I'm terrible, I shouldn't have done this, why did I do that, I made a big mistake. That's attacking yourself, right? The bird attacks themselves in the mirror. So if you have anti-reflective coated, that's what I'm teaching here. Anti-reflective coated mind, so you don't have the past and future anymore. You don't reflect the past, you don't worry about the future, so you're free, so you don't attack anybody, you're just here. And sliding doors into this hall. Into this hall. Sliding doors make even more noise. So you have a door. So instead of having a sliding door, let's just keep it open all the time. Then it won't make any noise. So you have the open door of your heart. It doesn't slide, it doesn't close, and therefore it doesn't make any noise. The door of your heart is always open to whatever noise or disturbance is in your life. And that's a real door which you should make open all the time. So as when it gets the doors, you don't need any fundraising for that. Just open the door of your heart to whatever happens in life. Not just the nice stuff or the unpleasant stuff. So people bang the doors and they make screeching noises. And the birds peck at the windows and poo outside. Open the door of your heart. And then there will be no more noise. Dear Ajahn Perfect, i.e. nobody. Because I remember I said yesterday, nobody's perfect. I'm a nobody, therefore I'm perfect. It seems that Mara is a chief executive control freak, always getting us to believe happiness is just out of reach, or somewhere other than here and now, and interfering in the process. Could you please say a little about the first indriya, confidence or trust, and the role it plays in helping circumvent Mara's control? Heaps of metta and gratitude for a nice retreat. This sadha, faith and trust. Number one, you have faith and trust in yourself, that I can do it. And that's one of the hardest of like faiths to actually have. You can have faith in the teacher, you can have faith in the Dhamma, in the path, but the faith which people don't have when they come on retreats is themselves. They think, oh, I can't do this. I've been on this retreat so often. I always, you know, end up losing it. Maybe I should just go off and do something else in life. As some people in Singapore used to say, I might as well become a Christian. At least as a Christian, you don't have to meditate, and you can drink, and you can eat beef, and you can do all sorts of other things, all sorts of cool stuff. But no, you can do it. And you have all these examples of people. I told you about that person who was a bikie, had all his tattoos on, and they got into jhana. They can do it. So why not you in the time of the Buddha? Had all sorts of interesting people becoming enlightened. There was Amber Pali. She was a prostitute. She became really enlightened. You got the dwarf, Bada the dwarf. Who else did you have? It was really interesting cases who became fully enlightened in the suttas. Angulimala, serial killer. He became fully enlightened. So, is there any serial killers here? So if you're not a serial killer, you're ahead of the game. And you have an easier time than Angulimala. So if you can do it, they can do it. You have people who had no education, street sweepers. All sorts of people became enlightened. So if they can, you can. So you have faith that you can do it. The nicest thing, though, is just before the Buddha passed away, somebody asked him this really nice question. In other religions and practices, can they still have enlightened beings? And it's sometimes a great question. And the way the Buddha answered it was just absolutely brilliant. He said, look, it doesn't matter what religion you are or what you call yourself. As long as you practice Eightfold Path, wherever you find the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find streamliners, once returners, non-returners, arahats. It doesn't depend upon the person. It depends on what you do. So as long as you're practicing Eightfold Path, then eventually there'll be screaming once returning, non-returning Arahat. Guaranteed. So can you practice the Eightfold Path? If you can, then you can become enlightened. Can girls become enlightened? Can you practice the Eightfold Path? Then you can become enlightened. Can gays become enlightened? Can they practice the Eightfold Path? Of course they can. Can old people become enlightened? Of course they can. They can practice the Eightfold Path. So as long as you can practice the Eightfold Path, then you can become enlightened. End of story. So that gives you confidence and faith that you can do it. And what is always interesting to me is when people get these nimittas. Even already during interviews, somebody's come up and said, I had these interviews, but you know, I keep doubting them, and maybe they're not real. And why do you doubt them? Because they are real. You do get a nimitta, but why do you think, no, it couldn't be, not me? Yes, you too. So you can do these things. And it's an amazing thing when you do start getting these great states of meditation, you get incredible insights, and you go back and look in the teachings of the Buddha, and they're real ones. And you're doing it. It can be done. You know, there are some people who say that these days you can't become enlightened anymore. The best you can do is hope to be born with Maitreya the Buddha and when he comes next time. Total lack of faith in their own abilities. You don't need to wait that long. Come on, aren't you impatient? You want to wait that long to become enlightened when it's really available now? So it's available. So just practice the Eightfold Path. You can do it. And that's the faith in yourself. And when you come on these retreats, again, it's wonderful when people come and say, yeah, I'm getting peaceful meditation. Even you are. Have that as a lift in your confidence. Yes, you can do it. And that will actually take you further. If you can get this far, why not go all the way? And you can get jhanas, you can get enlightenment. Why not? People in the time of the Buddha did. And are people in the time of the Buddha any different than people today? Absolutely not. Exactly the same. Is it breaking a precept to eat meat brought from the butchers or supermarket, meat that you did not specifically kill? I ask because I suffer from severe food intolerances, and all I can really eat is meat, vegetables, and bone broths without daily side effect. Thanks. No, I say, as long as you give the cow or the pig a lobotomy first of all and turn it into a vegetable. Well, a cow is only processed grass. People hate me for saying such things. But anyway, no, this is what the Buddha actually said, because he did actually realize that some people, they can't exist. No, without some meat. If you can, good. If you can't, then good as too. This is what the Buddha said for the monks. And he made this very clear. He had the opportunity to say, monks, do not eat meat. And that was asked by Devadatta. And the Buddha said, no. And I used to be a vegetarian before I was a monk. And then when I went to Thailand, I had to eat flesh. Flesh of frogs and crickets and ants and snails. And disgusting stuff. And I would have given anything to be a vegetarian in those days. So, you know, this is what they ate, the villagers ate, that's what you have to eat. So, yeah, there's no problem there. You're not breaking the precepts. You're a pretty cool person. Thank you. Yeah, I should put some more jumpers on. When you said deep meditation, is it jhana or nimitta? Both. But I've got to be very careful because, you know, it's against the rules for me to say that, you know, that I can get this and I can get that. So in order to bypass the rules as much as I can, I keep saying deep meditation because that can mean anything. So because if I said, you know, that I got jhana, I did jhana this and jhana that, a lot of the monks would actually come up and just sort of really criticize me big time. So we're not allowed, particularly number 8. We actually say our attainments. And if you have any psychic powers, you're supposed to keep them quiet. You're not supposed to tell people. Because, you know, imagine what would happen you know, if I could levitate, if I levitated in front of you, what would happen? What would happen is that the Australian Olympic Committee would get me to go into the high jump in the Brazil Olympics. It's not cheating. If you ever look at the rules, you know, you can do that. And then get the gold medal. If I could really read minds, no, really, and people would actually believe that and it was true, the Australian Secret Service, they would get me to interrogate all these potential terrorists. I'd be able to find out exactly sort of who's a terrorist and what they're planning to do. That would save the Secret Service a lot of money. They wouldn't have to worry about the CIA anymore. They'd just get Ajahn Brahm. So you can see it'd just be a lot of trouble. You know, if you know you let go, you had sort of psychic powers and stuff. So we always keep it quiet. And could you elaborate on the four consequences of being attracted to meditation bliss or enlightenment? Those are four stages of enlightenment: stream meaning, once returning, non-returning, arahat. The first stage of enlightenment, very quickly, because otherwise you can give whole talks on this. The first stage of enlightenment, stream winning, is actually to see there's no one in here. It's the experience of non-self. When you see, you know, this body is not yours, most people can understand that. But have you really let go of the body? You know whether you let go of the body when the doctor tells you you've only got 6 days to live. 4 days to live. And if you're attached to the body, you'd be very afraid. If when the doctor says only 4 days to live, you tell the doctor, can you make it two, please? One. I want to get out of here as quickly as possible. And if you tell the doctor that, then you sort of say, okay, fair enough, you're not attached to the body. Or the great Kesari Dharmananda, apparently this doctor who's an oncologist told me this personally, this is the only man he's ever known, a woman as well, who when he was told that his cancer was terminal, there was no possible cure, he burst out laughing. Now that's a monk. So you say you're going to die. Yes. That's great when you know, terminal cancer, you're out of here. So that's actually that a person who is a stream winner, at least they're not attached to, sorry, at least they're not attached to their body. Number two, they realize this thing called will, like I said this morning, it's not coming from you. You're not the person who does this. You didn't choose anything. You're conditioned, brainwashed, hypnotized, whatever you wish to call it, cause and effect. That's where your will comes from. And please don't blame me for telling bad jokes. It's just my will has been conditioned. It's not me. There's nobody in here, okay? No one to blame. It's just, you know, just who I am. Just it's conditioned mostly by my father, because he would always tell bad jokes. You know, one of the jokes I heard from him, from my father. He used to say, "What fun does a monk have?" And he would answer, "None." I've heard him say that so many times. So, you know, it's conditioning, okay? Just, you know, you're the child of your father. So anyway, so that's conditioning. So your will is not you. Now that's a huge insight to have. It's counterintuitive. Right now, you'll never be able to believe that. And then to see this thing which knows is also fades away. It can cease. Because those are the two parts, the will and the knower, which people hold on to as their essential being, their self. And when you see that through deep meditation, well, there's no one here anymore. Like Ajahn Chah said, why? There's nothing, no one here. For some people, that's scary. But actually, it's the most beautiful, peaceful, wonderful thing. When there's no one in here, there's no one to worry about anymore. Oh, what a relief. And so that's the stream winning, and that has consequences. When you're a stream winner, when you realize there's no one in here, there's no one to attach to anything. All right? This is a spooky story. I sort of, you know, was always wondering about this attachment business. You know, I became a monk, okay? So I gave up girls. Well, that was a big thing for a young man, 23 years of age, to give up sort of romance and sex. I was heterosexual. I like girls. And then you'd let go of that. And then you got into food. It's incredible, just even this disgusting food, now you still have a sensory desire for. And then it's like I was holding on to girls and romance, sex. I put that down, I picked up something else. And so I let go of food, and there was something else, like sweet tea or something, condensed milk. You put that down, you went into attach to something else. And when I ever let go of one thing, I was always picking up something else. It was endless. And I thought, how can you really let go? And then I realized that this is what a hand does. A hand picks up. That's its function. And what a sense of self does, it attaches to things. It picks things up. That's what the sense of self, the idea of me, will do. Whenever there's a me, there's a mine. So I realized with the sense of the hand, a hand, that's what it does, picks things up. The only way to stop picking things up is to cut off the hand. And then when you don't have any hand, you can't pick anything up. The only way to let go of attachments, not temporary, I'm teaching you to do it temporarily here, full on, full time, is to let go, cut off the sense of me. The I has to vanish, and then you let go. Now, you know that I was meditating, I think it was here in the early years, in Perth, and I came up with that simile, the simile of the hand. And I thought, what a great simile that was. I make up similes, you know, the thousand petal lotus, that's a my one. No, what's the other one, the frog and the tadpole, that's a my one, didn't get that from Ajahn Chah. And the picking up the cup and cutting off the hand, that was my one. Until one day I was reading through the Samyutta Nikaya and I saw the simile of the hand by the Buddha. Ooh, that was just, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck just came up. Because, you know, I hadn't read that before. And did I invent that? Did I see the same as the Buddha saw? Unlikely. More likely, I had heard that before. A long time ago. So that was really spooky when I came up with that. But that's what a stream winner is, and this is what happens afterwards. When there's no self, you tend to let go of things. And all your attachments start to unravel, disappear. Until you've let go of all your attachments to the world of the five senses. You're not interested in that world anymore. Instead, you're interested in the happiness of the sixth sense, the mind. And that is a basic definition of a non-returner. You don't come back to this world anymore. You've had enough with five senses, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, what's the other one, sort of hearing. Been there, done that, and it's this irritation, this sense world. So you don't get attracted back again. They're just like, have you seen the Great Wall of China yet? How many of you want to go and see the Great Wall of China? Have you seen Niagara Falls? Do you want to go and see Niagara Falls? Do you want to see the great Serengeti plains of Africa? Do you want to sort of see Mount Everest? And that's all sense pleasures. What do you want to do that for? I always tell people, if you want to see the Great Wall of China, just go to Bodhinyana Monastery, see our wall. That's a wall, that's great enough. If you want to see Niagara Falls, just go in the shower, turn on the water, that's a waterfall. What's the difference? If you want to see the Amazon, just go outside, there's enough trees there. A tree is a tree, it's in the bark and leaves and stuff. What's the difference? So after a while, just what do you want to do these things for? A lot of times people go and see these things because they're just following what other people do. Totally conditioned. And I remember when we went on a pilgrimage to India, we finished off in Delhi, so you had to go and see the Taj Mahal. Have you seen the Taj Mahal? Why is it beautiful? It's supposed to be one of the most beautiful buildings in the world, architecturally perfect. And I remember just sitting down there and thinking, why? What's perfect about this? What's beautiful about it? And I realized it's because I've been told it's beautiful, that's all. Total conditioning. And you believe what you're told. Nothing more. Look, you guys, look at beautiful women. Go and see these portraits of beautiful women 100 years ago. They were fat. So any fat girl, it's just bad luck. You were born in the wrong age. You could be hot chick 100 years ago. That's absolutely true. Now, thin girls didn't cut the ice in the 19th century. You know, they were considered to be sickly. And I grew up in the 50s, and I remember the supermodel Twiggy, if any of you remember Twiggy. And when I was a young guy growing up, she was really hot. I really liked her. And then as a monk, you see these pictures of the 60s, and did I really like that? That's disgusting. All of the fashion, beauty, whatever it is, it's totally conditioned. So, you know, you see that these things are just 5 cents worth, nothing there. And the only difference between an anagami and an arahat, the anagami is still likes his jhanas or her jhanas a bit too much. Being attached to the jhanas, really attached, is just basically you're an anagami, not an arahat. But quite frankly, many of you will be quite satisfied with that by the end of the retreat. So that's good enough. So those are the stages of enlightenment. Anyway, when I first got here, I was tired, cranky and grumpy because I've been working very hard without a proper bake. Now at the halfway mark, I'm tired, cranky and grumpy. I made that up. Now at the halfway mark, I'm much calmer, rested and peaceful, despite falling asleep every time I meditate. Excellent. You know, it's making progress. Because sometimes, you know, people, they judge, I can meditate for an hour, and they think that's progress. But no, this person has got some wisdom. You notice your progress by, you know, your cranky meter, your grumpy meter, and that is much more important than just how many hours you can sit, you know, without falling asleep. You're letting go, you're becoming more peaceful and happy. Well done. I know nimittas and jhanas are necessary for enlightenment. I just want a more peaceful and happy life, and sleeping meditation give me that. Then that's surely good enough. Yes. Even if I sleep throughout the retreat and don't get any deep meditation, I'll still be going home a better person when I arrive. Yes. That is a very, very wise person. Yes, good enough. So, when you lower the level, you have much more happiness. Which is one of my sayings, lower your expectations if you want to be peaceful. For those of you still looking for a partner in life, lower your expectations. Otherwise you'll never find anybody. And if they lower your expectations, you know, they might, you know, hitch up with you. We have such high expectations of life, and that's why we get angry and upset. You're not good enough. I'm not good enough. The retreat is not good enough. The food is not good enough. We have too high expectations. Lower your expectations, it means you're contented and easily satisfied. So, lower your expectations mean lessen your craving. You're more peaceful. During the retreat, afterwards you can do whatever you want. But while you're meditating, lower expectations and you become very peaceful. How do we meditate on the first object that comes into our mind during sitting? Can the object be an incident, a problem, a desire, a memory, or has it to be a physical object like a person, a deity, or a thing? If the object is my family, do I pick up only one person from the family or one after another? Do I just observe the object or try to be kind to the object? Do I need to stay with this one object for the entire duration of the meditation? Oh, no. Don't choose whatever it is right now. So something's already here. That's what you watch. So you don't choose and you don't say it should be this, it should be that. When you close your eyes and you meditate, are you aware of something? What is it? That's all you need to be aware of. And be kind to it. If it's this family member, if it changes by itself, fine. If it doesn't change, fine. You only have one object at a time. What's happening now? So it's just getting into the present moment and not moving over to this and moving over to that. Like I said, you know, whenever I go traveling, and I just go traveling many places, I just came back from Indonesia. Actually, I didn't move. I didn't move at all during that journey. I sat perfectly still in my seat. The aircraft moved, but I didn't. So I never traveled anywhere. This is like meditation. Just sitting here being perfectly still. And these objects are moving, but you're not. Just like the person sitting in the aircraft. So that's actually how we watch whatever's there. May I suggest leaving shoes on the other side? Yes. After you die, you go to the other side. So leave all your shoes on the other side. The rain's coming, they'll get wet, most likely. Happened to me with sprinklers. I said, okay, that's what the shoes are there for, to protect your feet. And now we want to protect the shoes by having shoes on top of the shoes. So if you get like another shoe, so shoes underneath the shoes, so your shoes don't get dirty. And then you get undershoes, so the shoes under your shoes, so your undershoes don't get dirty. And that's what happens. Now you see people, it was raining the other day, but they don't use the umbrellas because they don't want to get the umbrellas wet. Shoes are supposed to get wet. That's what they're there for. That's what your skin's there for. The skin's supposed to get wet, you know, and dirty. That's why we have showers. It's supposed to get wet to protect what's underneath. Your skin has been evolved to get wet. That's why, you know, it doesn't soak into, you know, your nose and your eyes. It just falls off your skin. So it's supposed to get wet. So no worries. Let yourself get wet. Please teach us body sweeping meditation. I did follow it on YouTube once. It was good and helps to relax the body. Is it hard to relax the body? I cannot understand why. Any ideas? Okay. It's a body sweeping. You can't go over it in full because it takes at least half an hour. But there's many of the body sweeping guided meditations available, which, you know, I did ask if it can be available. Danny's not here this evening. Maybe Burr. Anyone wants a guided body sweeping meditation, you'll find that online. And basically all it is, you start with one part of the body. You relax your body, not all in one go. That's too much. You choose a part of the body. So I usually like to start with the toes. So I can feel my toes. Now, because you're aware, you can actually start feeling these things. If you can't feel them, you actually touch them, squeeze them, or whatever. Make some contact there. So you become sensitive to your toes. And then I will them to relax. And I never thought that was possible before I started doing this. You can actually relax your own toes. You may think your back is tense, you know, or you've got your shoulders are tense. But your toes being tense? What do you mean? Yeah, they are. That's sometimes why you have foot massages, to relax your feet, and then that relaxes the rest of the body. So you relax your toes. You can feel them relaxing. Then you go to your feet. You go to your ankles, up to your calves, your knees, your thighs, your bottom. You're relaxing everything as you go up, little by little. And your mindfulness gives you feedback. You can feel the body relaxing. And it really feels nice. It feels good. It's pleasant. You get to your bottom and you think, this pressure on the bottom, how can I relax that? But you can. That feeling gets less because it's always part of you, tightens up. You know, your will, your brain gets in there and just interferes and tightens it up, puts pressure on here. And when you relax, you just let go of that pressure. So you relax. And the reason I start with the toes, because by the time you swept up to the waist, then by that time you've got enough mindfulness and enough skill in relaxing that when you get to the important parts, you know, all these organs and stuff in your torso, you can relax some more. So, you know, you get to sort of, you know, maybe your colon, maybe, you know, you've got some indigestion there, you've got chronic... bowel syndrome, irritable bowel syndrome. Yeah, I always tell people, you should always, you know, for intuition, always follow your gut feeling, except when you've got irritable bowel syndrome. So you've got irritable bowel syndrome, which many people have these days. So you're aware of that feeling, and you can actually learn how to relax it. You can actually cure your own irritable bowel syndrome, just by learning how to relax. You got that feeling there? The feeling changes. You find out what you're actually doing to make the feeling less tight, less pressure, less tension there. It feels a bit less. You can move it even more less of pain and relaxing, relaxing, relaxing until it's gone. And it's incredible what you can do by just focusing on one part of the body, mindful and kind. It's called kindfulness. And then you just sweep it up through the body. And I was mentioning the other day, but for girls, when you get to your breasts, by this time you've built up a lot of mindfulness and kindness. You can relax anything. And sometimes people feel, it's really hard to put it in words, there's a an imbalance there. You can feel there's something not quite right. Some tension there, you relax it, and the feeling changes, and the feeling starts to feel really good. And then when you move away from there, you just avoided the breast cancer. It's amazing what you can do. You relax everything. Can you go up to your shoulders and relax those? Well, that's always a bit tense. You relax those, go down your arms to your hands, relax everything. Then you go back up to your shoulders, to your neck, relax that. And go to the front of the face. Relax the feelings around the eyes and the nose. And the mouth, sorry. That's why I never need Botox, because I can relax all of this. Save a lot of money, girls. No more, was it crow's feet, whatever it's called. And anyway, everything gets nice and relaxed. And you know, you can actually feel things healing really nice and relaxed like that. And lastly, you know, I go to 2 inches behind my eyes, in the middle of the brain. And all the people in biology tell me there's no nerve endings inside the brain. So you shouldn't have any feelings there. But I imagine a feeling in the brain and I relax it. And by relaxing the brain I get really, really cool and peaceful and still. And just very, very nice. The whole body is just totally relaxed because I've done it methodically, one by one. And that was so nice. And then I can go and just go to the breath, anything I want to do. And my body is already so peaceful, and I've strengthened mindfulness and kindness. So I know how to relax things. So you go on to the mental world, it's so easy to relax it. Get to the breath, relax the breath, get so soft, and then get to nimittas, relax them too. Nimittas and amid pulsing or coming and going. Just aware, just they get really still and soft and lovely. So the whole thing just works all the way to the deep meditations. We're just starting with the body. It's important with the body because we all have sicknesses from time to time and they're all stress related basically. And even at this point I mention a person I know in Sydney, she's a Buddhist and she's also a therapist. You know, people Buddhists, they're trying to find some good livelihood so they can help people but also pay their bills. And she started her company, it may still be online, sleeplikeababy.com. And so she cures people with insomnia. And her method is exactly that sweeping method I just told you. And when I last saw her, she said she's making a fortune. Because it's 100% success rate. People who can't sleep at night have all this insomnia, they take this pill and that medication doesn't work. So instead they lie in their bed and they start with their toes and sweep up, relax their toes, then their feet, then their ankles. Usually before you get to your butt, you're fast asleep. Totally relaxed. So that's how it works. Oh, I'm going to be in trouble. My mother-in-law. Mother's-in-law. These are really good stories. You know, if you rearrange the letters of mother-in-law, you know it spells Hitler woman. Go back tonight, mother-in-law, and it rearranged the letters, and it spells Hitler woman. Really, honestly. My mother-in-law follows the Mahayana tradition, and in her temple there's a lot of chanting, which, to be honest, I hate. She encourages me to join her because she says, although I don't understand what they are chanting, because it's in Chinese, it's still good karma, which I disagree and feel that it's a waste of time. I'd rather sit at home and listen to a Dhamma talk on YouTube. What's the best way of making her understand this? I know she has the best intentions, and I feel it is just not for me. Maybe you can record the chanting, you know, for hours and hours and hours, and then play it at high speed. So it only takes a couple of seconds. So I listened to all the chanting, Mum. Because apparently I went to one of these Tibetan temples and they had the prayer wheels. They had the prayer wheels and the idea, the old days had a prayer wheel and there was like a chant in it. You turned it around and it made the chant. So you didn't have to do the chant, you know, the wheel did it for you. But now they've got these high-tech wheels and they've got billions of chants because they're all on computer chips or something and the wheel turns really fast. You just press the button. So the Tibetan prayer wheels, they do many more chants than they've ever done before. maybe it's high tech. So maybe if charging is, and they have these little machines these days when people are dying, the charging machines goes round and round and round. Now, I've always said that, the Heart Sutra, the Mahayana, they put it in the next to the coffin when a person's dead, and they just continual charging, because it's hard to get monks and more people to do charging for such a long time. So it's much easier to do. And I don't know if you've heard that in Japan, Japanese culture is they always love Christian weddings, because, the white weddings, it's romantic. But they always have Buddhist funerals. And it was so hard to get monks to go to the Buddhist funerals, because there wasn't that many, and there was too many people dying. So that one enterprising company got the robot monk. So, it's absolutely true. They got this robot, dressed in robes, just like a monk, bald-headed. And when the funeral starts, they press a button, and it has absolutely perfect charging every time. And don't cost much money, because, sometimes you have to pay. Some monks charge thousands for funeral services. And, they use your guilt. If you don't really love your mum, then you won't pay the money. So, you love your mum, pay the money. It's really gross. But anyway, this guy doesn't cost anything, just about a few cents for the electricity. And apparently, after he's done this perfect chanting, this company has made this robot monk rise up into the air, and he goes through a trapdoor in the ceiling, this beautiful dry ice. And it's really popular. Just robot chanting. Why not? So anyway, you can tell her, why not sort of get a robot to listen to the chanting, or even a robot to do the chanting. And you can pay for it. And that means you don't have to go and do it yourself. But it is much better to listen to the Dharma on YouTube. Because in the old days, all the chanting was, it was just the teachings. It was the way that the monks and the nuns remembered the teachings before we had books. So we just had to keep memorizing it by chanting over and over and over again until we memorized it. Now we have books, we don't need to do that. It's just a ceremony these days. So it's much better to sit and listen than to chant. Also, my mother-in-law takes trips from time to time, organized by her temple. She shares with me her experience when she's back. My mother-in-law is the best mother-in-law I could ever hope for, but at times I feel she listens and follows what the senior monk teaches them without thinking, without investigating, as if their word is final. I disagree on many occasions, but don't know how to tell her without sounding like my teacher's better than yours. Please advise. She's such a kind soul, I don't want to hurt her feelings. Like, for instance, she went to a meditation course which was very strict, back straight or get hit on the back kind of course. How do I tell her about the middle way and that this technique is not very good? I don't know if you remember me telling you when I was in Hong Kong, I met a Chinese monk who said that recently there was such a retreat held in mainland China, where the senior monk, the teacher, went round the back of everybody, and if anyone was nodding, they got hit by a stick. And this middle-aged Chinese woman, was meditating, and she was nodding, she got whacked on the back with a stick by the master. And she immediately got out her mobile phone, called the police, and the police came and arrested that monk. They took him away, because you can't do that in China anymore. So be careful, nuns. Monks, if you try that in some countries, you've got no defense. You'll go to jail for that. So it is going a bit too far. But if your mother-in-law is very old, and if that's what she's been doing for such a long time, she's not going to change because of you. So sometimes it's best to humor her. She's not doing a bad thing. She's going to chant and going to Buddhist temples. At least it's not going to the casino to gamble and stuff like that and playing mahjong all day. So it's not a bad thing she's doing. So, good. Good on her. Is that the same that, when somebody dies and you say, what chanting should I do? Should I do Theravada chanting? Oh, do whatever chanting your mother likes. Because it's for her, not for you. It makes her happy. So, but actually to changing her, sometimes it's so difficult. Sometimes you can get a book, you can get a teaching, and just maybe leave it around the house. Maybe she'll pick it up, maybe she won't. And maybe give her the opportunity by having resources,
know, in obviously Chinese, if she's Chinese speaking, in her dialect, which, you know, she may be able just to listen when she's bored and maybe see a different way of doing things. So that might work. I have had problems going to sleep at night because of busyness, so I end up washing my breath to calm my thoughts. That's how I can manage to go to sleep. The problem is now, when I wash my breath, I always fall asleep. Please help. So you have watching your have one way of watching the breath for sleep, another way of watching the breath for meditating. For example, sometimes we do lying down meditation because it's a comfortable position to lay down. But if I do laying down meditation, I always lay down in a position where I don't usually go to sleep. I don't know why, but I never go to sleep laying on my back. So if I want to do meditation, I lay on my back. And then it's like my body position tells my brain that he doesn't want to go to sleep, so I stay awake. And if I go on my side, that's my sleep posture. So if I'm on my side, I'd better not try to meditate because my brain will get confused. He's on his back, he must want to go to sleep, so I go to sleep. So if you're watching your breath when you go to sleep at night and that's the way you go to sleep, fine, that's really important. But see if you can get a physical position where you don't usually go to sleep in. If you go to sleep on your tummy, then meditate on your back or whatever. And that means you get a different signal to the brain. You don't really want to meditate, you want to just you want to sleep. Well, you don't want to sleep, you want to meditate. So that's one way you can do it. And you calm your thoughts down, which is good. But if you want to stay awake, you know, when you're meditating, you're watching your breath, you calm your thoughts down, see if you can get some joy and happiness coming up when you're watching the breath. You're not just letting go of the past and the future to calm down, you're also getting some happiness in, some joy. So notice, when you are calm, it actually feels good, it feels peaceful, it feels joyful, it feels interesting. And that means that we will have enough interest and mindfulness to stop you going to sleep. So try that one. Dear Supermonk, you know that I did meet, where was it? I think it was in Singapore, someone who was a personal friend of Steven Spielberg. And I noticed on the aircraft, again, all those movies about Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, and stuff like that. And, you know, I read all those comics when I was a kid. And, you know, they run out of superheroes. They've been there, done that. So I was suggesting, because when I first went to Thailand, there was a cartoon in the newspapers when I was first in Thailand, in Thai, called Supermonk. And they would show me the adventures of Supermonk in Thailand. And he obviously could levitate, so he flew through the air, you know, to save people. And when he ever got the baddies, because he had, you know, just really superpowers and do all sorts of things, he could, you know, stop people from destroying the earth or crashing aircraft. But he would never call the police. He'd just give them the five precepts, and they'd become Buddhists and become good after that. And so I suggested, you know, to Stephen, by this guy, now the next franchise should be Supermonk. And all the amazing, just, you know, what you can do. So whenever someone's trying to destroy the world, there's no violence, you know, just like, you know, some of these other superheroes, you know, smashing them and having these very violent battles. This Supermonk just, you know, gets the guy, bad guy about to destroy the world and just teaches them Dhamma, gives loving kindness, and always very forgiving, you know, just, you know, just one death ray machine doesn't make you a bad person. And also praising a person, because a lot of times these people become evil super villains simply because they've had a bad childhood. And so you just forgive them. I can understand where you're coming from. People have never loved you or been kind to you, but I love you and kind to you. You know, whoever the super villain is. And because he knows psychology and he knows loving kindness, these super villains who are just really out to destroy everything become these beautiful, kind, peaceful people. And then you give them the five precepts, and, you know, some of the super villains can become monks themselves or nuns. And then it's the end of the problem. There's great scripts I could write for Supermonk. But I got the message back that no, it won't work. No sex, no violence, because no one goes to watch the movie.
So unfortunately, Super Monk didn't really fly. Anyway, dear Super Monk, I was fated to meet you at a young age, and that opened up the world of the Dhamma to me. However, it saddens me that I can't reach out and pull my parents to join me on my path. Is it true that maybe their karma hasn't ripened for them to even come close to the Dhamma? I know I shouldn't preach, I've refrained myself from doing so, and I choose to show my actions instead, but sometimes it frustrates me at how they pray and follow all these cultural rituals and not learn the true path of being humans, being good people. It's not like they aren't good people, it's just that I've learned so much that somehow I don't know how to share it with them. Somehow it comes out wrong. Leave the book and ask them not to read it won't work. Even casually asking them to follow me to a Dhamma talk doesn't work. I just want to repay and show gratitude to my parents by sharing the path I'm on, but simply don't know how. Help. You know the Anathapindika? You know, he was one of the Buddha's chief disciples, late disciples. He gave the Jetagrodha monastery to the Buddha. But he had a son who was not interested in religion at all. And whenever Anathapindika told his son, oh, why didn't you go to the monastery? The Buddha's there, you know, he's a wise person. You'll learn so much. Ah, I'm not interested in that person at all. So he tried another way. Bribery. So he told his son, because sons always want money from their dad, that's why the best bank in the world is the bank of mum and dad. Mum and dad will give their children any amount of money with no interest, and sometimes you don't even need to repay it. So you know the bank of mum and dad. If you've got children, you know what I'm talking about. You know, you give them loans from their houses, loans for this, loans for that, and it's without any interest. So anyway, he was very rich. And so when his son was short of cash, can I borrow $100, Dad? He said, no, you can't borrow it, but for every hour you stay in the monastery, I'll give you $100. And you don't have to listen to any talk, you don't have to meditate, as long as you're in the grounds of the monastery, for every hour I'll give you $100. So he thought that was a really nice deal. Didn't have to do anything, just be there and get $100. So whenever he was short of cash, he'd go there and say, I was there for 2 hours, Dad, 200 please, and he'd give him $200. And this carried on for quite a while, and then just happened naturally, because he was staying in the monastery, trying to get a bit more cash to mess around in his life. And he was bored. And he thought, well, these people are listening to the Buddha. And he said, well, I've got nothing else to do. I might as well go and listen myself. Because he had the resource close by, eventually, after a while, it would have to happen. Just out of interest, he'd go and listen. So he went to listen to the Buddha. And afterwards, he went back home and gave all the money back. Thank you, Dad. I've listened to the Dhamma. Now I'm a Buddhist. I understand why you did this. It was a skillful means. So I don't know how you can get your parents, you know, to go to the temple, you know, maybe bribing them, maybe just, I don't know what they like to do, if they like to play mahjong, saying there's a really good mahjong club in the temple. Anything just to bribe them to get in there. And okay, they're not going to sort of listen to the Dhamma talk at first, but eventually, because it's happening close by, eventually they'll get interested, just curiosity. And that would maybe get them in. Maybe. Who knows? Depends how old they are. If not, wait till they go to sleep. And when they're fast asleep, creep into their room and start playing the talks. So it gets into them subconsciously. Is that being sneaky, bad? Who knows? Maybe that might work. Some of the jokes, no, that will turn them off. The khandhas are not ours, so why do we practice so hard to escape from samsara? Exactly, why are you practicing so hard to sit here and let go? In theory, you say I shouldn't practice so hard, but can you do it? You know, somebody in the interviews, I challenged them. See if you can do nothing for one day. Challenge it. I mean really doing nothing. Can you do that? No, it's just too difficult. It takes a lot of skill to do nothing, because we're habitual doers. Trying to get somewhere, trying to do something, trying to go somewhere. But just to be here, we've lost the art of just being. Even meditating, you're meditating to try and get somewhere. You're trying to improve your meditation. You're trying to
get more wise. You're trying to get rid of your problems. You're trying to get rid of your diseases. You're always trying to do something. So that's why it's almost impossible for you just to be. And the reason is, yeah, it's true, the candles are not yours. But you don't believe that. You think, deep down, your view deep down is they are yours. And when that view is always there, when you're not a screen winner, you'll always be doing something with your candles. So why do we practice so hard to escape from samsara? To realize the candles aren't yours. Why not just do nothing, since all of this nonsense is not our business? Exactly. It's not my business to answer that question. And your five candles don't need to have breakfast tomorrow morning. Not yours, none of your business. I like walking meditation, but after a while I get disease. One teacher said that because I did not concentrate enough, another teacher said because of too much concentration, please help. And lack of ease, I think. Too much concentration, not enough concentration. Concentration, too much, too little is wrong anyway. Don't do any concentration. That's your problem. This is not a concentration camp. So this is a stillness camp. So see if you can just let go of the concentration, just be, instead of trying to get something. Something is not going right. What's that joke about the person who got hit by a truck and lost half his body? And the relatives said, you know, so what's up with him? And he said, there's nothing left, but it'll be all right. I can think about it. Okay, it's a bit late. So something is not going right, therefore it must be going left. I feel like giving hugs to everybody. Eh? In their teeth. This is horrible. I don't like emotions. Can't even smell it right. Spell it right. I-M-O. Emotions. I who used to dislike giving a hug to my own daughters. I don't want to go in this path. I think it's dangerous. I feel like every cell of my body is filled with love. Please help. I'm going to start contemplating a super and death. I don't like this. Please help. Where are you? Teddy bear. Another nice teddy bear. So in other words, they're just being sarcastic. It's going right. You're giving hugs to everybody. You're getting some kindness, some joy, and it's wonderful. It's not horrible. You don't like emotions, but you're stuck with them. It's part of being a human being. So you better get used to them pretty quickly. And it's not dangerous. I feel like every cell of my body is filled with love. Please help. No way. Can nimitta be in any other colour than white? How long does it last? Yeah, it can be any colours, nimittas. And there's one guy, he had a... First time I knew that someone could get a black nimitta. He said he saw this light is really jet black. I'd never heard that before. And then, but I asked him, what was it really like? He said it was the most beautiful black he'd ever seen. Like satin, like deepest black you'd ever experienced in the whole world. You don't see black like that in the real world, he said. And it was just so beautiful. It was shimmering. It was like glowing black, but really deep black. Yeah, okay, yeah, that's nimitta. But you know, you have it in all sorts of colours. So there we go. On the second day, I tried very hard to focus on the breath, but the thoughts distracted my attention, of course. I followed your advice and let go by giving time and effort to sit for a good cause, and it really helps me to just be in the present moment without trying very hard. Very good. This morning I borrow your teddy bear to practice, starting in the awareness of the body and followed by feeling the gentleness of the teddy bear. Yeah. I had the most amazing sitting experience, realizing the joy of being in the present moment, the feeling of kindness and gentleness. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for this enlightening incense. Thank you to Ajahn Teddy Bear. I guess I could hardly hug Ajahn Teddy Bear tomorrow. Hee hee hee. So yeah, it does actually work. People actually do the meditation because most people don't have enough kindness. This just brings that little bit of kindness back, and it means that you actually get nice meditation. Can people achieve jhana through walking meditation? I always thought the answer to that question was no, until somebody told me there was a monk in Thailand who could get jhana through walking meditation. And the evidence, the proof of that was all of the band-aids and bandages on his head. Because when you're in jhanas, you've got no sense of the five senses. You don't know where you're going. You can't see, you can't hear, you can't feel. So you keep banging into things. And that's actually the proof. Yeah, he probably did get into jhana when he was walking meditation. So if you went into jhana when you're walking in this hall here, you wouldn't know to stop. You'd go straight into the wall. So it is not recommended. But usually most people can't. Sometimes meditation can feel like trying to vanish. Other times it is more like opening to what you experience or even take yourself to be. The latter approach feels freer and more loving and happier. Could you comment, please? Yeah, that's right. Sometimes you don't need to ask me these questions. You can feel it yourself. It feels freer and happier. Yes, amazing. That must be right. So don't just follow the teacher. Don't follow what you're learning. Follow what you know. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. Is it possible to get into a jhana while doing walking meditation? I told you, this happens all the time on these retreats. You get these two questions, or the same question comes up, different persons around about the same time. It shows you are resonating with each other. Because this was just, you know, almost next to each other. It's interesting, just happens so often. Same question, different people, and always close together in the box. Has any person got enlightened while doing walking meditation? Yes. You can get enlightened doing walking meditation. Every year I see you, you look not getting older. Even your skin is more glowing. Is it because of jhana or silly jokes? No, it's because I use Nivea, or whatever else it is. Anti-aging cream. Available from the shop. I don't have anti-aging cream. No, it's just a lot of happiness, a lot of joy, a lot of peace. Even though I work very hard. Dear Ajahn, during the interview this morning, you mentioned about stable nimitta. Can you please further elaborate what is that? When people first get these lights in their mind, they move around. I've just mentioned this to you. I haven't mentioned it yet. So often, the nimitta is at the corner somewhere, above somewhere. And people make the mistake, it's over here, so they go looking for it and it goes away. Or it's up here, and you're looking up here and it goes away. Don't go looking for your nimitta. If it's in the corner, you just stay here. It's going to come to you. It's just checking you out, as it were. And if you know you're stable enough, it'll just come and center itself. Don't move. And so it centers itself. Sometimes it throbs, sometimes it goes around in vortexes, all sorts of stuff. And there's no end to just how it moves, but you want it to actually to slow down. So it just becomes very still, and it doesn't go anywhere. Just still, what stays right in front of you. And that is called stabilizing the nimitta, keeping it still. And I said earlier, the only reason it moves is because you're moving. You've got a powerful mind, the five senses have been subdued, the sixth sense is very strong, but you're still moving around a bit. So you just need to really learn how to relax. And the simile from Ajahn Chah is really good of the still forest pool. When he used to go into the jungles, he would always find a lake or a river because you need to wash, get some filter some water for drinking, and then he'd just go meditate next to the lake, about, you know, 10, 15, 20 meters away. Because in the night time, the animals would come out to drink. This was before Nature Channel. So to see the animals come and drink and play was just great entertainment for a monk. And so he would sit there with his eyes open. But if he moved, the animals would know there was a human being there. They wouldn't come out because they didn't know whether it was a monk or a hunter. So they'd be so scared that even though they were thirsty, they would stay in the forest, in the jungle. He said sometimes it was very, very still. The animals would come out, they'd look around, and they would smell. And if they didn't think there was a human being there, because he was so still, they'd come out and drink and play. And they're young by the pool. And he said you had to be very still for them to come out. He said sometimes it was incredibly still. And then his very rare animals came out, the beautiful animals which very few people see. And they would come out to play by the still forest pool, as long as he was still. If he even moved slightly and said, wow, they would hear him and would run away again. And that simile, the ordinary animals were the limiters. They only come out and play in your mind if you're still. It's as if they know you're watching them, then they won't come. They'd be so still, and then they come and play. And the amazing animals are the jhanas. They would only come out to play in your mind if you're perfectly still. Now, it's Ajahn Chah's simile. It's actually brilliant. So I remember when I got these nimittas moving around, I remember that simile, and I imagined I was Ajahn Chah in the forest, in the jungle. And my job was to be perfectly still. When I was still, the nimittas were still. When I was really still, all this other stuff happened as well. I can imagine this thing which was knowing, sitting perfectly still, not moving at all. And that was how the nimittas become stable. We should learn from different masters so that we can be more all-rounded. This is what I learned from so many different masters. That's why I became rounded. I learned from Ajahn Baked Bean. What if a person has already ordained as a monk nun? Is he or she still allowed to learn from different masters? Of course you are. You learn from different masters. That's why that usually I was encouraged after, you know, being with Ajahn Chah for 5 years, going to visit other teachers in Thailand. That was what you expected to do. It was really similar to in Europe. They used to have these trades. You started off as an apprentice. So you'd stay with one master. Maybe it was a carpenter or a steel worker. You'd stay with one master and you'd learn as much as you could as an apprentice. And once you finished as an apprentice, you went to the next stage as a journeyman, which meant you would go to the different shops, carpenter shops, metal shops, to learn from different masters. And once you've been a journeyman for a few years, then you could actually set up your own shop and become a master craftsman, a master stonemason, a master carpenter. And that was actually the way that the trades were organized in medieval Europe. You know, from being an apprentice to a journeyman to a master. And this was all organized by the guilds. The guilds of stonemasons, the guilds of carpenters. And that's actually how we learn. And that's almost exactly the same as in the tradition of Buddhist monks and nuns. First 5 years you should stay with your teacher, roughly. And then you're expected to go visiting other teachers or maybe stay by yourself. The time when you're free from Nisaya. And then eventually you're expected to start your own little monastery, where you become the master. And that was the tradition. So from the very early times you're expected to learn from different masters. And that's actually our tradition. And it obviously makes sense. I'm finding my heightened awareness is really intense. Even when I brush my teeth, it feels like they're going through the car wash. What a good idea. Is this how you feel all the time? Yeah, I'm going through the car wash. It's true, and it's very wonderful. It's not unpleasant, it's intense, but you know, quite sort of invigorating and sometimes joyful. And especially when you go out into nature, you feel the cold, you feel the rain, you feel the sun on your skin. It's lovely. Because you're aware, it's like you become alive again, instead of like dull. Ajahn, the other night you told us the story of the man who meditates and goes into a deep state of stillness that people thought he was dead. My question is, aren't we supposed to be mindful and be aware in every moment during meditation? He was mindful. I remember saying that. He was more mindful than ever been before, but not of his body, of his sixth sense. His mindfulness was intense inside. He wasn't sort of in a coma or unconscious. He was fully conscious, but inside, but not of his body. So yeah, he was aware. If one meditates in the deep woods, and if such a case like this happens, then would there be any danger to one's safety? Okay, here's a story from the Samyutta Nikaya. It did happen in the time of the Buddha, and it was written about. There was a monk who was meditating in the forest, in the jungle. He went into a jhana, perfectly still, and two Buddhist villagers came past. And they saw the venerable, sitting perfectly still. They checked up on him, and they couldn't see him breathing, nothing was moving. They thought, oh my goodness, the venerable has died. And if we leave him like this, he's going to be eaten by the jungle animals. We can't let a venerable die like that. We must at least give him a proper funeral. So he was in the jungle anyway. So they decided to collect some wood and make a funeral pyre, which only took them a half an hour to do. And they put the venerable on top and they lit the wood. And once the fire was taken on the wood, they realized, the wood would do the rest of the job. They were busy people, they couldn't hang around all day. So off they went to collect their mushrooms or their plants in the jungle, having cremated the monk. So they thought. And they were very impressed the following morning when they saw the same monk come into the village for alms food. Not even his robe was charred. Because that's what happens when you get into these jhanas. You become invulnerable. So don't worry. If you happen to get into jhana ananda, and if we decide to cremate you, we put you in the oven and say our goodbyes, and then when they actually, the guy opens up the oven door again, hi, it's me again. You're invulnerable. And that's the theory, and again, I always like saying that I met one monk who I don't mind saying who it is now because he passed away. That was Sudhamma in Indonesia. And when I was a young monk, I met him, and he was really a powerful monk. And he told me his story that he was a lay person in Java when there's still lots of jungles. He wanted to become a rishi, like a hermit. So he hadn't ordained yet. He went deep into the jungle, sat down meditating. And he told me, just typical jhana experience, this star came into him, into his mind, brilliant star. And his English wasn't that good, he said he married the star. And he just totally joined into it. It was a jhana experience, and that was for a long time, he didn't know how long, but it was actually many days. And when he came out of his meditation, he noticed the jungle where he was sitting had changed. Many things had been broken off. He checked with the villagers, there had been a flood there. And he'd been under a couple of meters of water for days. Didn't know a thing. Because he was deep in meditation, totally safe. And one of my other close friends, she was a princess, but she went to Chelsea Art School. And the guy she married, he went to the same school as me. So, we were friends. I knew this princess. And she went to this temple, Wat Bawon, where this monk was teaching meditation. And she told me that she was in the class one Sunday afternoon or morning, and something weird was happening, so she opened her eyes. And she promises me this is exactly what happened. She said she saw rays of light coming out of this monk's eyes going into another meditator, just like in the movies. But this was real. This monk could actually do his rays of light from his eyes. And she caught him doing it. That's cool. And that was one of these monks. And he was actually underwater for days. Totally invulnerable. And I only say his name now because he passed away a couple of years ago. So, we don't tell stories about monks while they're still alive. Because otherwise it embarrasses them. And people just start sort of harassing them. So, can I see your lights, please? So you're perfectly safe when you get into these jhanas, nothing can harm you. Is soy milk allowed after 12 p.m. as milk substitute like creamer? We have so many arguments about what goes into your mouth in the afternoon. So yeah, go on, go for it. If you want it, why not? So instead of worrying what goes into your mouth, please worry what comes out of it. Keep noble silence, please. So if it's comfortable for you, milk, soy milk, we usually allow that, don't we? Yeah, we usually allow milk, soy milk, whatever you want. This is that that straight celibate male again. You are so cute and round and cuddly and kind. Can I keep you? Are you really straight? Because why did the chicken cross the road? It didn't. It was a chicken, not duck. Quack, quack, quack. How can you see the duck actually using the duck crossings here, Perth? It's so cute. Can I please... Oh, when the ducks actually cross the road, they are cute. Can I please use the paper at the table down the back? That's kept for writing. Sometimes to you, to write love letters to my family. Thank you, your roundness with emptiness in the middle. Whatever. Anyway, that's very deep. Too deep for me. Very good. Dear most round roundness. Buddhists are generally known as passive, and although they don't propagate violence, they often don't take a stand against it either. Well, this is an interesting question. I'll feel something is amiss here as actively engaged compassion is absent. Personally, I find it difficult to sit back aloof and detached when others are suffering. Is there something I can do to help? Yet I meet many Buddhists who choose not to be involved or speak up against wrongdoing, and they seem to have a more peaceful, simple life. There can be an expectation that good Buddhists remain passive, docile, and not critical in nearly every situation. What is the Buddhist understanding on how detachment and compassion work together, and how can we cultivate a compassionate approach to life in a balanced, responsible way? Thank you for doing just that. You're an inspiration. That's always a really tough question. If you see something wrong, you know, how aggressive should you be? How, in even violence, is violence always a bad thing to do? If you see a kid trying to cross the road in front of a truck, of course you'll push him out of the way. And even the Buddha used to say, if your son has got a fishbone stuck down his throat, you know, you put your finger down there to get the fishbone out, even if your kid is screaming in agony. You know, because sometimes it's the compassion, sometimes can hurt somebody. But it's such a dangerous thing, because most people aren't wise enough to understand just what is compassion and what is ill will. Sometimes we get it all confused. I always like telling the story of the Boy Scout. You know, out of compassion, he sort of helped an old lady cross the road. Out of compassion. The trouble was, she didn't want to go. So be careful sometimes. When we have compassion without wisdom, we can create a lot of problems. And that is sometimes the difficulty with action. We always think that we're going to have a war to end wars, or we're going to be... aggressive, for actually to stop more violence, that, you know, we can execute, you know, all the drug dealers and all of these killers, and that will make a safer world. It doesn't seem to do that. So I know that one of the, because I do every now and again meet political leaders, they ask you, have you any ideas how to solve these big problems in the world? How can you solve, you know, so the problem of, you know, Islamic extremism, for example. And I always like quoting that young girl Malala, or there was actually another Muslim intellectual, Ali Hirst Ali, who wrote some incredible books. She came to Perth some time ago. And, you know, she was a Muslim woman. And she actually was saying that if you want to try and stop the extreme Islamic violence in the world, just, you know, fighting that with violence will just make more people join their cause. He said one of the most effective ways to counter Islamic extremism is actually to encourage education for women and advancing their status in the families. And this was actually from a Muslim woman. And I always say that was one of the reasons why the Taliban targeted that young girl, Malala, who was speaking up and encouraging other girls in Pakistan to have a good education. Because, you know, some of these Islamic leaders, the Taliban, they're not stupid. They're highly intelligent, and they know that if you give some equity through education to women, that will be the end of their extremism. And so this is like wise ways to solve a problem without violence, because violence just leads to more violence. There are other ways of doing these, solving these problems. And that is where Buddhism, you know, with its wisdom, with its compassion, can actually come to the assistance of world problems. Even like other problems about what about climate change, you know, which is destroying our world. You can't just sit there and meditate and think that, you know, that's going to solve that big problem. But there's another way of solving that problem, because the biggest environmental threat of our planet is overpopulation. So we need more monks and nuns. And that, we're doing our bit, I'm doing my bit. And so I think the governments of our world should actually subsidize monasteries, because we're actually helping lessen, you know, climate change and the consumption of resources, because we don't use very much. You know, we're very simple living people. So if there was, you know, every, you know, 10% of the world's population were monks and nuns, or 20%, then that was solving all the problems of climate change and violence and everything else. So that's my solution. All the governments in the world should subsidize monasteries and build heaps of them so we can have more monks and nuns, and then we won't have any of these problems. What do you reckon? But anyway, just education, you know, from that Ali Hirsali was a very brilliant solution. And it doesn't cost as much money as bullets and bombs. And it solves the problem. But it takes a while to solve these problems. But one of the nice things with Buddhists, we are patient. If we don't solve the problem in this life, you know, we can do it in the next life. I often do 8 precepts at home. Is it okay if my husband hugs me and kisses my cheek before he goes to work or sleep? Can I still sleep in the same bed? Is it okay if my bed is a high one? Yeah. Of course your husband can hug and kiss you before you go to work or sleep. The 8 precepts is not really sort of sexuality to hug someone, you know, who is, I'm hugging the teddy bear. Am I breaking my precepts by hugging the teddy bear? So just imagine your husband is a teddy bear, and then you can give him a hug, and then it's not breaking your precepts. So actually, probably no, as long as it only goes to that point. Depends actually how old and ugly your husband is. If he's old and ugly, no problem. If he's young and hot, be careful. There is a lovely older lady on the retreat who always smiles and is so cute. Sometimes when I meditate, I see her and feel like giving her a big squeeze. What's all this hugging and squeezing? There's something going on. Is it normal to feel like that, or should I give her a hug when I see her next, or would that be weird? Yeah, definitely weird. So you know, okay, it's 9:30, we'll finish off, so too many, not that many to go. So, but to finish off, all of you who like hugging, please follow me. Hands out, bring them in, and give yourself a big hug. Okay, you've got all your hugging over now, so you don't have to hug anybody else. So, again, a few more left here, sorry for that. So it's 9:30, time for go to bed. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. And don't hug the kangaroos outside, otherwise you're in big trouble.